And we're back. And you are listening to Villaincast, BJJ Antiheroes, with myself, Chris, the Villain Pains. Weekly podcast featuring either my fellow black belt, Naki Arshad, on our show Reap the Week, or compelling interviews with other personalities across jiu-jitsu. But first, a quick thank you to our members at In Theory BJJ, Concept Driven Jiu-Jitsu, for fight commentary, technique and concept videos, private coaching, monthly webinars and Q&A sessions, please visit www.patreon.com/InTheoryBJJ. Good evening, good day. It's afternoon for you, isn't it?
Hello, evening. Josh Janus. You know, 5 a.m. Yeah.
Evening, yeah. Hello again. This is our second go around on this podcast. The first one was so good. We thought we'd do it again. We got such good feedback off the last one. How have you been, sir, for the past eight or nine months?
Man, really, really well. I don't know if it's just us or like just the sport of jiu-jitsu is growing. Our school, White Lotus, here in Milwaukee, has just been exploded. It's just it's such a cool culture, so cool to see. And, you know, as you know, it's not like, I don't look at it as a business. It's not my business where I'm looking to put food on the table with, but to see the growth and to see just the excitement of jiu-jitsu, it's really cool. So I guess that adds to me doing really well. So thank you for asking.
Yeah, fair point. So we just had a quick chat before we came on, and it has been, I'm trying to think now, when was the last time I saw you? Did I even see you last year? I saw you in Maine. I think that was it, because you did Panu.
Camp. Yes.
I wasn't there. So I saw you at Maine camp.
Man, don't the years kind of run together?
Dude.
Sometimes it's...
It's been 3 years since we came out of the pandemic, and that just blows my mind. Like, since everything's came back to normal, apparently. And yeah, everything just seems to be blending together now. How was your tail end of last year then? So after you did Panu camp, did you do a winter camp at your gym, autumn camp?
Yeah, we do a winter camp and a summer camp here in Milwaukee. I know last year I also did Poland, Globetrotters Poland camp.
Yes.
In the middle of October. And man, that might be my favorite Globetrotter camp.
Oh, really? Why's that?
Yeah, I couldn't think of anything that's more me. Like, we did sauna, cold bath. It's like zen. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of breathing. Somehow I had some mushrooms that I was able to take and walk in a forest. And, you know, it's just an incredible experience. And it's like 120 people or something like that. So it's like kind of a medium-sized camp for Globetrotters standards. But it's just... I don't know. I really liked it. Have you done that one?
That's the one I haven't done yet. So I've done pretty much all the others, even winter camp now, but I've yet to do Zen. It's on my list. Hopefully I can make it this year. Who knows? I need to find out and ask Christian. Main camp, that was a very new experience as well. How being so far away from civilization, I guess it's kind of similar to the Zen camp, and then you're stuck there. But I think there's more partying aspect maybe to Maine than the Zen camp.
Yeah, which is why I kind of like Zen a little bit, because of that, it's a little less partying. Not that I'm against partying, it's just I partied a lot when I was 22.
Yeah, it's been a few years now.
Yeah.
One thing we were also talking about before we came on was Patreon, and so obviously I'm doing my own thing now of In Theory. And you said you've now started your own. When did you get into Patreon?
Just this last month. So, I really like what you guys, you and Charles, both with your Patreons. But just the idea of Patreon in general, and I kind of took it in maybe just a little bit different of a direction. So on mine, so I had a Fanatics video to be released through Fanatics. It was going to be Painless, Precise, and Playful, which is going to be a big topic of what I'd like to chat with you about, but not the video, but Painless, Precise, and Playful idea. So it was okay to have another Fanatics video, but then I was like, you know, like, I guess my videos do like okay, but not like great. I'm not, you know, killing it on Fanatics. And I was like, you know, maybe there's a way that I can do it myself and see if people support it. And so I have the first half of that video up on the Patreon now, and I'm gonna put the second half up within the next couple weeks. And then I was like, you know, I do a bunch of videos. I used to do a bunch of videos for my personal coaching because I have a company that does personal coaching as well. And so I was like, okay, well, what if I add some, you know, some personal development videos on there? What if we add some long, like longer form conversations with some of the coaches? Well, I also teach Wim Hof method and breathing. Well, why not put some of that on there? And so it's a combination. It's called Gentle Art Lifestyle. And it's everything for physical and mental balance.
Have you come across any issues with starting a Patreon up, like when it comes to video creation, or what kind of hurdles have you come across?
Well, we've been filming since January. So the Patreon just came out probably March 1st, but we've been filming since like beginning of January, all sorts of different videos. And finding an editor for all sorts of different types of videos, whether it be a jiu-jitsu video or for a personal development video or whatever, it's a pain in the ass, man. Like, I can't find somebody good. Maybe if you're good, please reach out. I have business for you. So I have that. Sorry, go ahead.
No, carry on. I think there was a bit of a lag. Carry on.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the editing portion of it, and then just making time in the schedule. So one of my other coaches for my coaching company, he lives here in Milwaukee, and we're able to meet, and we scheduled time each week to meet and film. So we're constantly filming different stuff, which is also you go from not filming to filming. You have to create a habit of it. So we're creating a habit of filming. He's picked up editing. So that for some of the easier things, that's useful. And it's just getting in the habit of doing it, you know, and spending the time to do it and that kind of stuff.
How have you found did you have the equipment yourself for filming, or is that something you've had to acquire? Or
yeah, had to acquire.
How's the skill jump been for that? Because I've been filming stuff now since that video came out 5 years ago. I've been trying to do my own stuff, and I've tried so many different things to try and get good content. And it's not necessarily the content is the problem, it's the filming of it. So the different cameras and different audio setups, and finally I think I'm onto something that actually comes across okay. And it's always audio. That seems to be the main crux of what people find as quality. I mean, even going through like just Instagram videos and like reels that pop up, or just adverts, it's the audio change that you'll pick up on more. Like someone could record with a potato, but as soon as the audio becomes problematic, like people just switch off. I'm like, right, okay, so that was always the crux. And when you're filming in a gym especially, and you've got so much echo, or you're moving around, that was the hardest hurdle I found.
What's interesting about filming a gym, because you guys filmed your seminars when you were traveling, correct?
Yes.
It seems, so that's something, because there's so much background noise. So for the instructional, that like, well, you know, Fanatics doesn't exactly do at least when I was there, which is now a couple of years back, when I filmed Guillotine Glossary 1 and 2, it was just, you know, Alex and a camera, essentially.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, so my friend who lives here in Milwaukee has a basement gym that has a camera above and then a camera in front of and then separate sound. So that's really, really useful, and it's a really great setup. Additionally, if we film jiu-jitsu at the gym, we bought one of those mics, super simple mics that go here, like just, so we clip it to the rash guard, And because, you know, we're making sure we're being cognizant of it. I think the sound comes off a little bit better for those.
Yeah, that seems to be the main crux of the quality change was always the sound. Have you found it with? I mean, that's it's kind of funny. Like, you know, I know I spoke to Charles about this. Is that considering we all got into this game and, you know, kind of stuck at this game because of the love of jiu-jitsu and the love of rolling and the game and everything else, and all of a sudden now we're becoming Instagram influencers and stuff like that. And it's like, I didn't sign up to become an influencer and like have to make videos and stuff. I mean, I absolutely
pretty soon,
enjoy it.
Pretty soon you're going to be wearing a little bit of clothing and you know, a little bit lower cut shirts, and all of a sudden I'm going to see you in, yeah, like, dude, little booty shorts and stuff.
It. Already wearing my branded stuff when I'm on camera.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not.
I got my Einstein stuff.
I'm not complaining. I mean, it's a lot of fun to engage with so many people, and this is, you know, I love. Essentially, it's almost a pandemic that we've all learned how to do this, and engage with people online. I love the conversations and the connections that I'm making with people, the relationships that are being created through this. I mean, I've actually now met people from the Patreon in person, and it's like, that's weird. And then people come up and say, oh, I love the podcast. I'm like, why? It's fantastic, but awesome. This is amazing. So you're talking about so there's a couple of things that came out of that then. You're talking about precision, painless, and playful.
Painless, precise, and playful. You got it. And also, start a self-deprecation chart here.
Oh no!
I got one so far, and then I'm just going to keep it going. And at the end of the podcast, we'll see how many times Chris was self-deprecating on something that he does well and shits on himself.
Okay, I'm conscious of it now. I forgot that you do this.
Yeah, like, not to judge, but to get you're good, man.
I'm not gonna lie. Like the last time we talked was probably one of the most challenging podcasts I've ever done.
Oh no! Like,
just because of how much you fuck with me sometimes. But it's all right. I want to do it again.
I'm so sorry. I don't mean to fuck with you. I just want to challenge your pigeonholing of yourself,
dude. If I remember our time in Milwaukee, which was 1 year ago now, it was beginning of March.
Oh, yeah.
That was a similar kind of deal. Although you did say, I can't go anywhere now that has rubber ducks without thinking of Milwaukee. Just so strange.
Yeah, I've acquired some guns and I've thought of you as well.
Really?
Yeah, it's America. You know, Americans have guns. You know,
right above the screen right now, where I'm looking at you, is the target we both shot at on my wall, like, along with photos of our trip. Not that's weird or anything. Yes, yeah, so,
I love it, man. There we go. I love it. It's like those are the small things that make life worth living, I think.
Absolutely. So position. Painless, precise, and playful. That, blah, dude, that name's going to confuse people and no one's ever going to find you. tell us about the Fanatics release.
Okay, so no Fanatics release. It's going to be on Patreon now, my Patreon.
Okay.
For a bunch of different reasons. Ultimately, what this is about, painless, precise, let's just say painless and precise, because playful's more about how we train and taking in as much information as possible so we can make better decisions. But painless and precise. There is not a submission that you can't do painlessly. Now, what does painlessly mean? Painlessly, like, let's just take a rear naked strangle, for example, right? If I come across your trachea and I lift your head up, that is going to fucking hurt. Right? Like, nobody likes that. If I if I take my arm and I have a good connection with my giant bicep on one side and then my forearm on the other, and then I just keep that connection and then I compress into the strangle, compression, not extension, that's not going to hurt. That's going to put you out. Okay, that's precise. Would you agree with that?
Yes, it's accuracy. I pretty much do the exact same class where the amount of effort actually needed to close a choke is you're closing two McDonald's straws. So anything more than a slight squeeze is kind of overdoing it, unless you're trying to overcome them pulling at you. But then if you're hitting the sides, it's more of a crank because you're hitting bone. And if you're hitting the front, you're crushing the windpipe, which again is not what you wanted. Right. Accuracy. I talk about roughly the same idea.
So, by the way, there's a lag, so I hear you, and then I see your mouth moving, which is kind of funny. Oh. I don't know if you have the same thing, but I'll just not pay attention to the screen.
For the best.
Okay, so you have this idea of being precise. However, how many times have you walked into a gym? How many times have you been in an open mat? How many times are people like, oh, Chris Payne's, I'm going to prove myself on Chris Payne's? And, you know, they get somewhere near your neck and they're just pulling on it, trying to pop your head off like a dandelion.
Yeah, all the time.
Luckily, we're good enough that we can survive that. And, you know, if we don't want that to happen most of the time, it doesn't. But for the vast, vast majority of people, they're walking into these situations and we think, oh, we're going to win this round, or we're going to get a tap is a tap. And that's just not the case, man. Like, if it's a Wednesday and we both just worked 8 hours at our jobs, you know, we're doing whatever we do, and then we go and train, we shouldn't have to worry about each round being a fight and some guy just ripping my head off because I need to win this round, or ripping my arm apart or ripping my leg apart. And this idea of a tap is a tap, or, you know, well, this is a violent sport. It can be, but also when we're with our training partners, it should be a safe space and we should understand what we're doing in each one of the submissions.
But even though, even if people have full understanding of how each submission works, would that be more of a cultural problem though? Because going around all the submissions, even though, you know, some of my students might not know all the intrinsic details of most submissions or finishes, or because then even taking that out, you have slams, you have stacks, you have various other things you could do to someone that doesn't even involve submitting them. Yet I'd say that to encourage that safe space, it's definitely a cultural thing, and that's something that's created from the top down. So we'll go on to that actually afterwards, like after we've talked about playful, I think, but and precision. But yeah, I think that it's I think culture definitely comes into that, which we'll go probably dive
and
into that.
That's exactly why I am on, like, why I'm all jazzed up about this topic, because I think the culture does need to change. And it's not like, I'm not suggesting that we all become like little bitches and we tap when somebody just grabs our hand, right? What I'm suggesting is that we don't have an ego and we play more. And when we play more, when we don't have to worry about our neck getting popped off, or we, you know, we can't walk for a week because somebody just, you know, ripped on a heel hook that I have no idea how to control. If once we get past that, and we start moving more, the movement is going to give us information, and that information is going to allow us to make better decisions as we're grappling.
Why does my screen keep going off? So it's since I made quite a few changes in the gym with regards to, so I don't teach submissions now for the first year. I would rather people. Connection's a bit off. There we go. See if that fixes it. Instead of getting people to do submissions, because that creates more of a I wouldn't say ego's a problem. Like, you know, people your will to win comes from ego, which, you know, we all want to win. It's just obviously the management of it. Which as soon as I kind of give people some submissions, they then go diving and they'll Hail Mary a lot more often. But if I say, right, well, positional dominance and being on top is what I want, and not being on the floor, like, I don't want you to play guard, I want you to stand up at all times, just because it's technically easier to figure out in those early days as well, and gives you more of a chance in competition of scoring points, etc., etc. It's a whole other conversation. But because of that, and because of a lot more takedowns and a lot more wrestling and a lot more putting people back on the floor, it was something that Rob Bianacki said on this podcast, you know, 6, 7, 8 months ago, whenever it was, of for the majority of people, your main form of competition is your own teammates. And the amount of people I get coming through in messages saying, oh, I'm a 150-pound purple belt and there's a 200-pound blue belt just kicking my ass all the time. How do I stop them? I'm like, well, that's a problem. Like, dealing right. with weight differentials, it's a power-based sport. That is going to be a problem. But also the idea that, why is your teammate competing with you so hard? Like, you're a team. I know we go into competitions and we say, oh, I'm representing White Lotus or Fighting Fit or In Theory or whatever, and, you know, represent the Shield or yada, yada, yada. Then you go back into your own gym, it's like, fuck you all. Like, you're eating it today.
right.
I think belts come into it a little bit, the hierarchy, as in, you know, I'm now here, you're down here, and I want to keep it that way in the hierarchy of the gym. But I'd say it creates some of the most toxic environments going, just in general. Not even like going for the extreme stuff, just the day-to-day toxicity of a jiu-jitsu gym of everyone above me, fuck you, I'm coming for you. Everyone below me, fuck you, you're staying there, and we've got this hierarchy. I will be as violent and as aggressive as needed to keep myself in this hierarchy. And when you're doing certain things like heel hooks or takedowns and slams, that then causes injuries.
So you said something interesting there that I'd like to kind of push back on a little bit. You okay. said that you Let's don't teach it. You don't teach submissions for the first year.
Nope.
Do you feel like then you are setting up your students for more of a possibility of injury or for, you know, what may be perceived as failure when they go to other open mats or things like that? Or do you think that then they're just going to say, well, I'm just going to learn these from YouTube if he's not going to teach them to me? So two questions there.
No, that's fair. I have had students come up to me in classes and say, like, when can I start going for things and trying to win? I was like, well, that you need to reframe then what you think of as a win. In that, being the person on top, positional dominance, that's how I want you to consider a win. If you can stay on top at all times, that's going to serve you better than throwing yourself into the floor trying to snatch every submission going. You also really don't have control yet to be able to apply things effectively. You don't have control of your own body. And absolutely, they do go to other gyms open mats, and they do recognize when they get caught in some submissions. I mean, we do submit them. I'm not saying that we don't submit white belts. We absolutely do submit white belts in the gym. But at the same time, I'm not trying to teach them submissions. I'm trying to teach them, right, when you play with each other, you work for positional dominance. You work to not be on your back and just stay on top. And then even when it comes to teaching submissions, eventually, the main thing I teach them is almost like what you're saying there. When it comes to especially arm bars or leg locks or kimuras, is, say, you know, teaching a heel hook to a beginner is, right, I want you to maintain control over the leg, over the hip, for at least 5 seconds, and count it down. Look at the other person, say mm-hmm. 5, 4, 3, and if you can hold it for 5, you're always going to finish that submission. But if you can't hold it for 5, that's where you're going to try and snatch things. But also, you're robbing the other person of the ability to learn their escapes, effective escapes from positional yes. controls. And so it's been wild shakeup, because especially when they look at things online, like you said, like YouTube, etc., like they all try and think of buggy chokes and stuff like that. And it's like, right, well, you're fighting off your back again. No, you're fighting from guard. You're fighting from these positions. Show me you can control them, then we'll talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely
I like that, a
mindset change. Funny enough, it was actually from talking to Rob Bianacchi as well. He said that for his first year, they only learn a rear naked choke and an arm triangle. I was like,
so
I like the idea.
I take a different approach in that. I feel as though my students are going to either learn. It's like the parent that has parties at their house for the high schoolers, because they know the high schoolers are going to drink, but you know, but safer in their basement than somewhere that's regulated or controlled. I guess I'm that hippie parent that allows their kids to drink, because I teach all the submissions in my white belt method class. But it comes with conversations, like, and sometimes difficult conversations of, you know, applications of things like, you know, hey, Chris, I was watching you grapple and I saw you go for that ankle and you went for it really fast with no control. I've said to you multiple times, we want to control with our legs, control with our arms. And then exactly same thing, like, you know, we're in agreement there. We need to control first, which is part of the preciseness of it, which is going to help the safety of our sport. But it's management of the room, management of the school, management of the people that you're training with. And while those conversations sometimes aren't fun, and sometimes they don't like it, or sometimes you have to be firm, and sometimes I don't like it, it's, I think, necessary for the culture to make sure that people are safe and people are doing it correctly. I'd like to tell a quick story, which I thought was really funny. I think you may enjoy it.
Sure, absolutely.
We had an open mat, maybe, I don't know, this is probably going back 4 months ago. And a woman came in, a blue belt woman, and she's like, hey, you're Josh, right? I'm like, yeah, you know, nice to meet you. And she's like, I have a competition coming up and my instructor doesn't teach any leg locks and I'm concerned. I hear at White Lotus you'll teach heel hooks to white belts. Will you show me some stuff? And like, part of me was like, I don't know if that's an insult. Like, you know, I'm teaching heel hooks to white belts, but the answer is, yeah, you can do everything safety. You have to be precise and you have to control. So I took that as kind of a badge of honor, you know, like, oh, okay, well, they don't learn leg locks until brown belt. I'll show you some stuff. So I ended up doing that because, frankly, I think everybody should be safe and shouldn't have that worry.
Yeah, completely. I'd say the majority of submissions, injuries come from ignorance, but also it's the... it's that egotistical problem again. I mean, the metaphor, I guess, that I give to the students at the gym when it comes to this stuff is that, because we have students on the mats who are 13, 14 years old. We have one guy who joined us at 70. So it's a big spread of ages. And especially when you're doing a very wrestling heavy style of always getting to your feet, putting people back on their ass, There's a high likelihood that that could lead to injury and especially if it's quite competitive. So the idea that I give is that, you know, I've got a son who should be going to sleep any time now. he's just about to turn 10 years old. And if I was to try and teach him how to be better in goal in soccer, football for anyone who isn't American, I have a choice.
Thank you.
I can, you know.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, just had to make sure. Everyone else like, what?
Yeah.
So I have a choice. I can either blast the ball at him, screw him, like I'm bigger and better than he is. I can blast the ball past him and just make it so he can never save it. I can chip the ball over his little head so he can never save it. I can kick the ball off the field because screw him, I don't want to play, he's only 10. Or I can kick the ball at a level that he may or may not save it. And only one of those is actually going to be useful. I mean, if he saves it, who gives a shit? Like, you know, I'm trying to make him better. Because tomorrow he might have a game, and they'll say, "Oh, you know, did you practice much over the weekend?" "Yeah, I played like 2 hours with my dad. How'd that go?" "Well, he just kicked the ball past me like for 2 hours." Or, "I can help him practice." And I said that in every instance in the gym, there's an adult and a child dynamic. There's someone who is either powerfully, more powerful than the other person, or more skilled. And it's up to that person to then find a level that makes the other person better, because a rising tide will raise all ships. And if you're just there trying to rack up wins on someone, then you're not helping this rising tide. Like, do the right thing by that person, technically, but allow them space to be able to improve. And I think pushing that and like taking almost belts out of the gym, like no one wears belts, even the black belts don't wear belts. It's a case of, right, we're all equal. We're all going to try and make each other better, because we want to go out and do well in competition and or whatever else we want to aim for. And then incorporating that with where it comes to submissions, you have to hold it for five. Even chokes, like don't squeeze your chokes. You have to hold them for five before you put pressure on. Like solidify your positional control. And even to a point where I was heel hooking one of my blue belts the other day. We were playing and you know, I latched onto his leg. I looked at him and I said, right, you know, he rolled around, he was trying to strip his leg and everything like that. I didn't finish it. After about 10 seconds, I just stared at him and went, "We're good?" He went, "Yes, we're good." And that's, you know, even though he was going crazy and I wanted to give him that chance to find his way out, I could have easily just got the finish, reset the round, but there's no point.
Right.
And since incorporating that, that's allowed us to then train these more risky rule sets of slams, takedowns, heel hooks, and no injuries. And it's shocked me that how easy that was almost to incorporate. And it's just a top-down cultural change of, we're not competing against each other anymore, screw that, we're a team.
So we talk, well, my other business that's not jiu-jitsu or gentle art lifestyle related is essentially culture coaching in business. Ultimately, it's for retention of clients, but or retention of employees. But it applies here as well. It really does have everything to do with the culture of the gym or wherever you work. That makes you want to come back. That makes it a safe environment. And so you've changed. It sounds like you've changed the way that you teach. That changed the environment. Is there, in that time, have you had to have like tough conversations with people? Have you, you know, has there been people that were at the gym that don't like the change? How did you mitigate that?
No, not really. I think the change has come across quite organically, as well as it's easily understandable, because then if anyone pretty much disagrees with that, you think that you have to have a hard look at yourself as to why. If you're coming in and think, no, I want to be able to submit and compete against the people in the gym, it's like, then you sound like a fool.
Well, I want to be the best, Chris. I want to be the best there ever was. I want to be the highest-end competitor. What then?
Well, exactly. But how are you going to get there without good training partners who carry you there? Like, it's a rising tide.
Yeah.
And so, we all are in agreement that we want to be the best, but you don't get there alone if you're part of a team. It's that we are a team aspect, and as soon as that, you know, it's funny that, like, you hear a lot of the competition sayings of jiu-jitsu is like, you know, you train with your team, but then you're out there alone. When you're on the mats, and no, you're still part of a team. Like, you go to competition, yeah. The team is still there with you, and everything you did with the team has got you here. And it's only through mistreatment of the team that would then cause you to not train as effectively. And I think not knowing that in my earlier coaching days is when we had more issues of people getting injured, of people like, you know, this 105-kilo guy just stabbed me on my neck and I'm only 80 kilos. Like, yeah, that's I need to have a word with him. I need to have a word with that person because they've just done a dick move. But the conversations of having dick moves has drastically fallen off. Like it's almost unheard of now having to do it.
So we had you said something a little bit ago that I took a note on, and you were talking about wrestling, like a kind of a not wrestling per se, like the sport of wrestling, but wrestling up, never being on your back. And then you said the word tension, and that's a key point for me, because something that I kind of become almost annoying that I say with my students is when you bring things to tension, they're more likely to break. The more that you roll at tension, the more likely you are to get injured. What do you think about that statement?
What point did I say tension? I can't remember saying tension.
It was like 5 minutes ago, probably. Like it was talking about like wrestling, like wrestling up, and like you like it puts more tension on something.
Oh no, I meant as in like a body tension, as in like your posture, like your back posture and stuff like that. It's not necessarily the case of putting. I meant as in having your body in a more. The way I kind of liken it to is like in any other sport where you have to generate power safely, it's through your back, and having that rounded out back and misaligned joints will cause you more injury, and limit your ability to generate power and move properly. So it's more a case of, same as every other sport, making sure your body is aligned the entire time as it's supposed to, instead of allowing it to be put into positions where it can easily be injured.
So
it wasn't necessarily a case of having
things
under tension.
Yeah, I think we're close to saying the same thing, but I'm not sure that I was able to communicate it. Let me give it a shot.
Sure. So,
if you have somebody that rolls, you know, and a lot of people roll like this, where let's say they were trying to pass your guard, and you can just feel both arms are just flexed and trying to pull you in or do whatever they're trying to do, and they're like, and they're squeezing everything. Their body is at tension, right? Like their arms, their back, their legs, depending on what's going on. But these things are at tension. Whereas when I roll, I try to, Megan is a real random side note, but Megan had this like semester of classes in our creativity in jiu-jitsu where we rolled like an airbender from Avatar: The Last Airbender. We rolled waterbender, earthbender, and now we're on firebender. But an airbender is like something where it's like you're never trying to fight at the point of, you know, like this. It's like this, and then it just goes with it and figures out the counter and is more motion, and things are not at tension as much when you're rolling like that. It has been my experience, what I learned, and it does seem to make sense to me that the less that you put your body in this tension state, whatever part of your body it happens to be, the less likely something is to break, just like a rubber band. A rubber band's not just going to fall apart unless it's super, super, super old. It's not just going to fall apart when it's not at tension. It's going to break when you pull it apart, right? And it's going to be more likely to break the more tension that you put on it and the more often you put tension on it.
I think that's I understand what you mean entirely, but I think, again, I think maybe I'm using the wrong words to describe it. It's not necessarily that they are clenched in a way, like squeezing the muscles, but as in they're just aligned. But relaxed in that alignment. So the drill that on the videos I'm going to be releasing for the seminars is where I ask people to, it's a old Aikido drill that I've known since I was 10 years old, where I ask people to put out their arm straight and tense their arm as hard as they can and get their partner to bend their arm so their fist comes towards their face. And I say, right, okay, because of that, you're going to hit yourself in the face. Like your muscles are acting against each other. So a little bit of tension in one way, fist to hit you in the face. Then I ask them to do it again. I say, right, same thing, but now relax your arm. Just keep your arm in the air and imagine it reaching through the far wall. And all of a sudden, their arm doesn't bend. And it's that kind of feeling that I ask people to do. I say, I want you to align yourself, but relax into that alignment. It's only when you tense your way through things that you actually have something acting against you all of a sudden, such as someone pulling on your neck, etc., that's then going to cause you issue and cause you injury or failure. But if you align yourself correctly, align your joints correctly, align your hips, your knees, your elbows, your shoulders, align your vertebrae in that relaxed state, you'll be more powerful and you're less likely to get injured when you suddenly have to generate power. Such as, you know, even when you're in guard, as in when I'm lying on my back, if I have a curvature in my spine from being relaxed in my thoracic, for example, and someone suddenly stacks me or just curls me up and grabs my head, I'm more likely to get injured. But if I can align it and then relax into that alignment and keep it aligned, it's less likely to get bent against my will, which, you know, if I then try and resist it, I'm then going to hurt my muscles, etc. So it's making sure they roll in that, not necessarily their bodies, like I say, they're not squeezing, but their muscles are in a weird form of tension where they're aligned but relaxed into it.
That's a really also cool agree with this whole, relaxing.
I also agree with the whole airbender thing. It was actually something that I got from Nick Gregoriadis, one of Roger Gracie's first black belt, I think it was, where he talked about the classical elements of earth, air, wind, fire, etc., water. And he said, you know, you have rocks crushing people, you have air floating on people, you have water, which is surrounding people, and you have fire, which is the aggression. And so being able to teach that for the past 10 years, exactly the same idea. Almost like there was one lad who was very much under tension all the time. Like, he was always squeezing and always fighting with himself. And so I blindfolded him and said, right, if you... it was almost like an old Wing Chun sticky hands drill, where if you tense your arms, you're not going to feel the punch coming. But if you relax and just put your arm against it, you'll feel and be able to block it instantly. And it's the exact same idea. Like, you know, when you're on the bottom of side control, putting your hand against the hip and you feel the weight change, and then you know to shrimp instead of always pushing against them. So blindfolding them and saying, right, relax, align yourself, but connect, and then feel the changes instead of always fighting against me.
I like that. That's also, I didn't know that. I've never heard anybody else put it into the elements like that. So it's good to... Who did you say you did that?
It was Nick Gregoriadis. It would be about 10 years ago, so I might have completely messed up who said it, but I'm pretty sure it was Nick, and he talked about those kind of classical elements of earth, wind, fire, water.
Well, that is awesome. Okay. Anyway, so I think, kind of coming back to the whole safety thing, if you're going to do submissions, you should, in my opinion, understand what you're doing. You shouldn't crank.
Yes.
And I think we've come to the understanding that the culture is the biggest piece in this. That being said, I see people teach, let's stick with strangles, but it can apply everywhere. I see people teach, let's say guillotine. Obviously, you know, I like guillotines. They'll say, okay, you get your arm here and you get your grip and then you squeeze. It's like, well, if their teachers are teaching that, then they're not going to know any difference. And, you know, then you hear the tap is a tap type of scenario. And I know why they say that, right? Like, if I was going to a regular class, a guillotine would probably be taught from full guard, which I never teach from full guard. The reason I don't teach from full guard is because also from full guard, you're trying to pull their head off like it's a dandelion, and that's not compression. And there's a lot of reasons not to do it. But from my perspective, let's know why things are happening and not just parrot what we were taught. And I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like most jiu-jitsu instructors aren't trying to make things their own or think about things intently. They're just parroting what they have heard from their coach, who heard from their coach, who heard from an old guy.
Oh, completely. I had the same conversation with Ryan Hall. Is that, and Preet actually said it really well initially, God bless him, is when he said, you know, what would be the first guard you would teach to a beginner. And the majority of the room will always answer close guard. And it's like, why? What's the first one we were taught? Okay, cool. Like, but is it the best guard to teach to a beginner? Probably not. So why are we still doing it? And even saying that to Ryan Hall, you know, I had the same conversation with him, and you know, talk about, you know, what would be the first guard, what would be the best guard to teach a beginner? So, well, open guard. Okay, so what's the first one you teach? Close guard. Why? He went,
right,
I don't know. And he came up back to me, like, messaged me 2 weeks afterwards, and was like, that's still bugging me. I can't believe I'm still doing that. And it's again one of those, I think it's one of those problems that the criteria for running a jiu-jitsu school is be a black belt, and the criteria for being a black belt is be a badass who could beat up people. That's it.
Right. And
there's no need to be a coach. There's no coaching qualification needed to run a jiu-jitsu school. It's why I can kick ass. I have kicked ass. Here's a go. Here's my certificate that says I can kick ass. You want to try me? I'll kick your ass. And it's like, oh, great, but can you explain jiu-jitsu? And so the safest option is always, well, this is how I was showing it. And if I show you how I was showing it, eventually you may become like me. But to step out of dogma half the time as well, especially as a jiu-jitsu owner, even if you have some resemblance of intelligence in your head, is that when you try and step outside of dogma, because we're in a competitive sport, are you fucking up your students by changing things so desperately? Because, you know, if you teach them wrong and they go into competition and get wrecked, it's on you. So is it sometimes safer to just do as everyone else does? And it causes little innovation. And it's only through recent change, I think money has changed things, is that all of a sudden you have these very smart people coaching athletes who are making a lot of money. And we have great communication now. And so all of a sudden you have these very intelligent coaches coming through, like Danaher, like Lachlan, who are going, right, this is explanations for why we're doing what we're doing. And everyone's going, oh my God, we've never even thought of that. Explaining why we're doing it? Oh, wow.
Right. Right. And that's, I think that's what I'm trying to do. Not, I think that is what I'm trying to do with Painless, Precise, and Playful. It's 27 basic submissions, but it's understanding why we're doing things. And it's little things, like make sure that we're bite with our legs, bite with our arms, break with the hips. And that's almost in general, you can apply that to almost every submission. I mean, there's some examples where you're using the ground, but I digress, right? And like, look at it, like, see if you're doing it in a way that, like, if you don't know why the arm is breaking, you just put your legs over the person and then you hip up towards the ceiling. You should know, right? Because it's never going to play out like that. First of all, it's not like anybody's just going to like lay there unless they really have no idea what they're doing, right? And therefore, let's understand what we're doing so we can make better decisions when people are moving it in real time.
Completely. I think as well, like the nomenclature that we've picked up over the years is an issue. Like the idea that, oh, I'm going to do an armbar. What are you going to do? I'm going to break her arm. No, you're not. Like, it's you don't break an arm with an armbar. You hyperextend the elbow and maybe tear some ligaments, but you don't break an arm. Breaking an arm means implying bones. We don't break bones. There are very, very, very few submissions that actually break bones, and it's usually by accident. It's usually ligament damage. And but saying, go on, go sprain her elbow in competition, it's like, that doesn't sound as cool.
I've never thought about it like that. Doesn't sound as cool. yeah,
like,
I guess.
It was like the sideline, like sprain her leg. Like, what? Okay.
grade two, or maybe grade, I don't know. Go for one of those
grade
sprains.
Grade two, her ankles. We don't break anything.
Yeah.
But it's the same with like rear naked choke, as a choke is a air denial.
Choke on a chicken bone.
Whilst strangulation is stopping blood going to the brain. So I completely agree. It's almost working backwards from everything. It's like, right, tell me what you're doing first. Like, oh, I'm breaking the arm. No, you're not. You're hyperextending the elbow through this part here, causing ligament damage. Okay, cool.
Right.
Or like even heel hooks. Even the idea that I still teach heel hooks and I ask people what is damage and people say the heel. I'm like, how? what can I possibly do to the heel? No, we're not doing that. There's definitely a nomenclature issue. I think that needs to be addressed. And it doesn't help when some certain coaches are speaking in Japanese as well. No, let's be as concise as we can here. Like, I'm going to say, I am going to latch onto their thigh because I want to put tension through their leg and damage their ACL or their LCL. Let's ignore everything else. It's too complicated otherwise.
Man, I totally agree. And it goes back to, you know, I think from our first podcast, how important words are, both in jiu-jitsu, but in our personal lives, right? Like, that the stories we tell ourselves and the narratives that we tell ourselves tend to come true. So, I couldn't agree with you more about the verbiage that we use.
Yes. And it's, yeah, I'm still, I guess, guilty of a lot of everything, but a lot of the wrong terms when it comes to, so in this one, I'm going to put tension through because I want to break their arm. No, I don't. I want to sprain their elbow.
I'm so happy you brought that because I'm definitely going to be using the Chris Payne's terminology. I never say break anyway, but I do find it pretty funny. Like, and this is where we attempt to sprain their elbow.
Yeah, it takes all the wind out of it, doesn't it? Like, yeah, that whole thing you said earlier. Like, how do you kind of calm people down in the gym, make them like less competitive? Just say those words. It kind of really derangs them a little bit. Like, what are you going to do? Sprain my shoulders? Like, come on, man.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think it was Lachlan actually, because obviously Lachlan's a physio, isn't he? And he was saying, right? Like, no, let's just fix this. We're not breaking shit in jiu-jitsu. We sprain stuff at best. Like, let's not sound as deadly as we are.
Bless him. I have a question for you. What are your thoughts on the ecological approach of jiu-jitsu?
Just as I'm about to go do the ecological camp in Florence in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, yeah, you're doing it?
Yeah. I'm doing it with Preet, Francesco, and Ed Ingermills from the UK. My personal thoughts are it's quite buzzwordy right now. It's something that a lot of us have been doing anyway for a long time. And I appreciate the fact that it's been, again, what a lot of us, interested and curious coaches have gravitated towards kind of naturally. We now have a textbook that we can lean in if we want further ways of understanding what we're doing. But at the same time, I don't think it's the answer to everything. Again, like, you can't just give ecological games and expect people to figure it out. Like, they may do eventually, but like we just talked about in our previous conversation is, are they really going to understand what they're doing on a biological level? Are they going to understand what they do on a physiological and physics level? No. And so the example I always give is this idea of a bonsai tree, as in depending where, certain parts of the tree, say getting up, just getting back to your feet or just holding someone down in certain ways, that's very much trunk of the tree. Which you can do quite ecologically. But when you start going up into the branches, into the leaves, which are very detail-orientated, that then you need to have someone who understands physics and physiology and can explain why we're doing what we're doing, how I'm generating power, where I'm generating power, where I'm generating pressure, how pressure is generated, and what I'm doing physiologically to that person. You wouldn't get that otherwise.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on ecological?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. I feel the same way about the ecological approach as I feel about Donald Trump. I don't have a problem. Like, all right, let me explain.
Yes, please.
I don't like Donald Trump.
Good.
However, if I don't broadly say because he's Donald Trump, everything he does is stupid and I hate him. Does that make sense? Like, I don't blindly hate the guy, and he had some good ideas. I can't stand how he communicates. Like, I want to bang my head against a wall every time I see him on anything. But I try to figure out, well, what are his actions? What is he doing? Okay. Now, ecological approach, I tend to the people selling it to me are people that seem like this is the only way to do something, and you should bow to that the pulpit of ecological approach. And yet, what's funny to me is, like, you know, it's all, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm going to very simplify this, but we create games and let people work through things and have them play. So obviously I love to play. I love that idea, right? However, you know, the books in the classes and now the eco camps, we just had one here in the States. Are these, I saw a part of a picture where everybody was around a guy at a table. Do you think they're playing games trying to learn how to do the ecological approach? Or are they coaching them, which you're not supposed to do, on how to not coach people? Does that make sense? Like, yeah, it seems to be a little disingenuous to me. That's how I'll phrase it, I guess.
Yes, I think some of those were more workshops on how to apply the idea of how to create games, like what kind of games to create what kind of outcomes. I don't know. I wasn't there, but I think from what, sure, I've heard, and then putting those games into practice, from what I have heard, it was just very wrestling heavy and very tiring. And I do have issue with the gamification as well, because we already do gamification. We spar. The game is, I want to win.
Mm-hmm.
Or we do situational, right, sparring. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And so, I, you know, even if it's not pure ecological, and I may get flack from the eco crowd for it, is the way I kind of see it is more of a case of, you know, just from the, I use the video games as a explanation, is that a video game isn't in competition with you. A video game is trying to teach you the game through the puzzles it creates. So such as, it'll give you an enemy that you have to jump on, and you'll realize this, you'll start jumping on them. You'll realize, oh, if it hits me here, I die. So I have to jump before it gets to me. And then over time, it'll increase the intensity of that kind of enemy until eventually it'll introduce a new complexity. It'll introduce a flying enemy. You go, oh, well, now I need to figure out how to deal with this new singular flying enemy. How am I going to deal with that? But the game isn't in competition with you. And I think to use the word game sometimes will cause people to become competitive, and then you have the same adult-child dynamic, which causes one person just lose and not learn anything. But if I say, right, you, one person is the puzzle maker, one person is the puzzle solver, we're not in competition with each other, but the puzzle maker is trying to educate the puzzle solver in the constraints that I have given, which is completely different to my understanding of what ecological is.
Yeah, so I think, and as usual, because obviously when Preet was here, we had some discussions on it as well. I like a lot of things about the ecological approach. Like, it does not make sense. So if I'm teaching something, let's say, like, all my gee strangles, I make sure that we're super precise and that we can do all gee strangles in a painless manner, right? So I will teach that. And then everything else, I'll say, okay, well, now we're going to start in this particular position, and, you know, one person is going to, they're going to try to defend, the other person is going to try to finish, we're going to both go 20%, and in this particular constraint, if there's any pain, then you've not done it correctly, right? Like, if you're just raking your too much muscle or whatever. So we'll set up things. I don't believe in drilling on a dead body as an example, right? Like, yep, here's my arm, no. Oh, here's my neck, up, tap, right? However, that is beneficial at certain points, but for the most part, I think that we should actively live drill, but at a level that both people can understand from, right? Exactly what you're saying. If I go with a white belt and I'm going 100% to win this game, there's zero chance that they're going to learn anything, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense, which goes back to what you were saying. So the schedule at White Lotus, on Mondays, we do an ecological class, meaning I'll come up with some situations, some games, and then I'll scale it up, right? Like, start off with something simple, and then depending on how it goes. I don't teach unless, there's something, if they didn't know, if a first day person comes in, doesn't know what a triangle is, and we happen to be working a position from a triangle or whatever, obviously I have to chill that. But so we have an ecological approach class on Mondays, and I have a lot of fun with it, but it's not I still will answer questions, and I still want people to have fun, and I still, if people are talking during it, it's okay, and all these things that I, from the eco classes that I've taken, or at least some of them, I just don't necessarily agree with.
No, I think it's definitely a buzzword right now, is there's this, because it's so outside of regular jiu-jitsu coaching, I think it just makes it easier to kind of, as a selling point, as, oh, I'm very different to how coaching has been, that we don't do dead drilling. But at the same time, it's like, anytime you've done situational sparring, okay, I'm going to try and pass your guard, you're going to try and sweep me. That's ecological. And so it's something that we've kind of done at a level forever.
Right.
But again, it's when there's a skill disparity and a power disparity, and when you definitely go down the gamification route, in a vacuum, makes sense. On paper, yep, it makes sense. But as soon as you start putting variables such as human beings in there, it doesn't make sense anymore. And again, we start going down that issue of people getting hurt.
Am I wrong in saying that it's weird to coach people it's weird to coach people on how to not coach people.
I get what you're saying, because it is funny to hear it. But at the same time, considering most of us have zero coaching ability anyway, and we've just been doing what our coaches have done forever, I think giving them some sort of intelligentsia to actually incorporate, I guess would classify as teaching someone how to do ecological instead of just dead drilling.
Yeah, that's not congruent. I don't know, that it drives me bonkers. You're gonna sit down and you're gonna listen to me, and I'm gonna tell you how to not tell people what to do.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I get it.
That's it. seems to make a ton of sense to me. Let's do it. I don't know. But again, as a good coach, there are a lot of things that are good about it, and those are the things that I need to disseminate for my students. And I'm certainly not right. I'm not right about this. Although, like I said, I do find that particular thing funny. I need to sift through it, and there is a lot of value to it. So I don't want to just shit on it. But
no.
There are funny incongruences I see.
That's why I liken it to, a lot of sports do use it. For example, football, soccer, whatever you want to call it. You could have that game where one person's going to try and strike and one person's going to try and save. And that's kind of ecological, because we're playing a game where I'm going to try and score and you're going to try and stop me. But at the same time, if you've got, a skill, power, whatever disparity, and that person's just blasting it past the other person, or that person just saving every shot, then one of those isn't learning anything, or both of them aren't learning anything. That's why the idea of puzzle maker, puzzle solver kind of makes more sense to me. Instead of just leaving them to the wolves.
How about the fact that we all learn differently as well, right? People are visual. Like you and I may be able to work through a finer detail of the Darce joke just sitting here talking. For some people, they're going to be like, what the fuck? I'm so lost, right? Some people need to feel that. Some people need to, they can't watch, they can't listen. They need to feel it. And that's the input that they need. And so, you know, I think offering different ways for people to learn is a valuable thing.
Oh, the kind of one that always sticks in my head, and it comes from a coach called Martin Rooney out in New Jersey, is a coach is someone who gets someone where they want to be when they cannot get there themselves. And so I look at every single person and I go, right, where do you want to be? Or if you don't know where you want to be, I'll help you try and figure out where you want to be. My job as your coach is to help you get there. And I will employ whatever tools I need to help you get there. If it's eco, if it's detail, if it's dead drilling, I don't care. But my job is to get you to where you want to be. And giving myself a varied toolkit to traverse these roads is in everyone's interest.
I like that quote, and I'm going to kind of maybe add a different perspective. As somebody who coaches for a living, not just jiu-jitsu, right? Like, jiu-jitsu isn't my living. But somebody that coaches for a living, whether it be in a business setting or whether it be in a personal setting, I don't believe necessarily that I'm trying to help somebody get to where they're going, although a lot of times it does end up that way. I believe that I try to give perspective and to give that person as much information so they can figure out where they want to go. Where those kind of a fork in the road between those is, you could come to me, Chris, and think that you want to be A, whatever A is, right? But as we go down this path and as I deliver as much information to you or as much perspective to you, you may say, no, now it's path B, right? And it's not like sometimes that information, making those pivots, is the right thing to do. So to me, coaching isn't about helping get somewhere. It's about being with somebody on a journey and giving them the most for them to make the best decisions.
Yeah, I think I think that both aspects come into it. So, funny enough, like part of the where this quote actually comes from, it was told from a perspective of a American football coach and a student, like a college level student or whatever it was. And
wait, was American like football? Mentored. That's the one with the odd shop ball.
The one that isn't foot or ball. That's the one.
Got it.
Trust me, the rest of the world's laughing.
I get it. It doesn't make any sense.
None of it does. It's told from that perspective, and one part of the story is that how this student is, you know, through the coach suddenly realizes that this whole path that they wanted to be on of go to the NFL isn't actually what they wanted. It was to actually like help, like bring money into the family, etc. And it's like, right, well,
yes.
All of a sudden, like, the direction we're on has changed, but I'm here to help you figure out where you want to be, but also to be the person that helps you get there. So I completely agree. It's another part of it. And, you know, it's half the conversations I have with students where I can sit down with them. It's like, right, where do you want to be? Well, are you sure you want to be there? Like, why are you doing this? And, you know, dialing back to what we were saying is ecological is part of the toolkit. It's not,
yes,
a be all and end all. Absolutely not. Like, you know, we've already established that there's so many nuances and things that we have to understand as coaches, even safety perspective. And so, almost like the first thing that I try and think of is when someone says, you know, when they were first walking to the room, is, well, I assume the reason you're here is to understand jiu-jitsu. You might not know it. We'll have a conversation about, you know, anywhere further you want to be. But right now, my job is to help you understand it, and I'll do whatever I can to help you understand it. And oddly enough, it's the speech I give when I give someone a brown belt, is up until this point, I've been trying to coach you into understanding jiu-jitsu. Now, it's my job, because you know as much as you need to know, it's my job to help you get to where you want to be, either as a coach, as someone who gives seminars, as someone who competes to a high level. You know, you are a brown belt. I can't help you anymore on the mats perspective. What I can do is use the connections that I've built to open doors for you to go down those other routes to become the black belt you want to be. Do you want to become a coach as well? Right, let's talk about how coaching works. Let's talk to people, get you on some camps and some seminars. Do you want to compete to a high level? Right, well, I've got connections with promoters. Let's get you out there. Let's go talk to some people. Let's figure out training programs. Let's give the right classes for you. Because teaching you jiu-jitsu, that part's passed. But still, I'm still your coach, just not in a professor way.
Yeah, I like that. That's interesting. But now that everybody that's a purple belt under you now knows what the speech is coming, you just ruined it.
I know, yeah. I know, but they all hear it anyway. It's just, it's their moment. Like, what do you want to be now? Let's go figure it out.
No, that's fun.
And it's something that I've kind of pushed anyway, because like Naki, you know, one of my black belts, when he was a brown belt, as I said, like, you know, what do you want to do? And one of those first things that I did was, okay, well, you know, you want to teach a few seminars. So I put a good word in for him with a camp in Amsterdam with Raul Haldu. I said, look, yep. Naki is one of my brown belts. He's an absolute monster, but he's also, you know, he was a high school teacher. So he understands how to deliver. Will you just give him a shot? And now he's getting his own seminars and getting his own camps just off his own back. And I'm like, right, good. Like, that's what I wanted for you. I can't help you with jiu-jitsu more. You're a peer when it comes to understanding jiu-jitsu. So I'll help you in another way. And now he's a black belt giving seminars. Like, yes, let's get you. That's the job of a coach.
You know, to me, this sounds like a little bit hippie, but to me, that's living on the frequency of love. Right? Finding out what it is and being selfless, because, you know, is he now, you could take it, and I obviously wouldn't, but you could take it as, oh, now there's another person that's competing for these limited amount of spots on these different camps or whatever the case may be. You could take it like that, right? But instead, you have love for that person. And you know, okay, well, this is what they want to do. Oh, good. Let me help them.
Well, I think that as a jiu-jitsu coach, if you're going to take up your own gym and have your own students, you either see them as a piggy bank or you see them as people that you are a coach to. And if you're not doing it in the latter, then that's when things start to fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've never felt using somebody as a piggy bank is the way to go, right? Like, just do what's best. Try to do what's best for the individual.
Completely. And again, you can see it with how you're coaching at White Lotus is that, you know, through your experience is that you're not using it as a piggy bank, and you take care and consideration to all the people that come in. It then feeds back into that, you know, back to what we said at the beginning. It feeds into the culture. Like, if it's from the top down, we've all heard enough stories by now of coaches who even go out and hurt their own students. I mean, one of the guys who actually listens to this even put on our group recently that because he's been using the defensive BJJ in his gym, the brown belt coach started to hurt him more for it and chastise him. And you think, so he walks out and you think, well, that's a person there all of a sudden who doesn't care about their student and has now lost the student. And the student's gone elsewhere and is now happier for it. Like, good. As it should be.
Yeah. That's so disappointing to hear, you know.
It's disappointing, continue.
It's a different topic. So if you were going to put an end cap on that.
No.
Go ahead.
It's capped.
Okay. I happened to look down at my notes and I wanted to ask you specifically for this because when I was talking to Adolfo, this came up and I don't know if I'm in the majority or the minority. I don't know. I don't know. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think is safer or better for an older grappler, gi or no gi?
Neither. It's culture that changes how safe jiu-jitsu is.
So if you were at a camp, let's say, you know, you have a 60-year-old student, purple belt, that is going to a Globetrotter camp, what would you suggest that he wears for most of the open mats?
Whatever they find safest for them. Like, whatever makes them happy. I have both in my classes, and it's whatever they find safest. Again, it's never the... I mean, I understand kind of like, you know, if you're wearing a gi, you wear a belt, and it shows off your rank, and then all of a sudden the hierarchy comes back into it. But at the same time, that's then a cultural thing, and I think having that part of you that says... this is a game. I don't feel safe playing this game with you.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if you're wearing gi, no gi, or singlet.
I've found, and this is, and Adolfo agreed with me, and I was kind of surprised, but most, I feel, especially older grapplers, feel like they have more control, understandably how they feel that way, in the gi, and they can slow down the athleticism of, you know, younger, young bucks.
Yeah, yeah.
However, to me, that puts a lot of tension on your grip, your fingers, of course, your arms, because you don't know how they're going to move. And additionally, and this is the biggest thing for me individually, is if I'm, you know, I'm wrestling with what would be like 110 kilo. That's big, right? That's a pretty big dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty big.
Okay, that's a monster. You know, if I'm grappling with a 110 kilo guy in the gi. If he gets a hold of me and applies his weight, I have to carry that weight in a different way than I would have to in no-gi. And what mm-hmm. we were talking about, and this is just not a lot of time into thinking about this, but what we were talking about is in no-gi, we don't have to carry the weight the same. We don't have the same amount of tension on our bodies that they're applying. And therefore... you know, especially if you knew some defensive jiu-jitsu, and instead of trying to frame with your hands or elbows, you're good with your shoulders and the angles off the floor and keeping your elbows back home, as I say, no-gi is actually a little bit safer. But again, comfort comes in. I'm already starting to not like me saying that, but I don't know. Just as a conversation point, I wonder.
No, completely.
I wonder if, yeah.
I mean, one of the things I currently say in class and in seminars is that jiu-jitsu is a power-based sport, and you know, we do our best to... It kind of goes back around to pretty much everything we've been saying, is in this power-based sport, when we go to competition, we try and control the power variable. So that's gender, weight, and age, because those are all power variables, and then we're measuring skill. And the other examples I give are horse racing, is that jockeys have to weigh in. Because then, if all the jockeys weigh the same, you're measuring the horse, not the horse with the lightest jockey. Or road racing on a bike. Bikes can't be under a certain weight, because then it's not the athlete plus the lightest bike, it's the athletes being measured. But then when you get into a general open mat, it's an absolute division. And power's going to be a huge factor. So if you're an older grappler, you could go against someone who's smaller but younger and generating more power, or you could go against someone who's just bigger. And I think then, again, like, it's gi or no gi, whatever your preferred style is, it's do you feel safe? And if you don't feel safe because that other person is not controlling their power and just in that variable and is likely going to hurt you, don't roll. Understand defensive jiu-jitsu, save yourself, get out. I mean, for example, I was at the Heidelberg camp and Silver Fox was there, and Silver Fox is a lot smaller than me and he's quite frail, but he's a very respected black belt, and I could have thought, well, I'm a young black belt, I want to test myself with him. But no, in no way. I controlled my weight over him at all times. There was no time I was going to put pressure on him. It was slow, it was very technical, and we had a great time. But again, it could have been very easy, especially if it was a brown belt or purple belt, to think, well, that Silver Fox, that is, he's a massively known black belt under Henzo. I want to go to town on this guy and get some respect. Silver Fox get injured. Yeah. Or maybe not. Silver Fox probably still waste him.
Right.
But again, it's doesn't matter which. It's always a case of all injuries, I believe, are more from culture than any sort of jiu-jitsu variable other than that.
Yeah. Which is, you know, what I'm trying to do with building this Patreon community in the culture around that is safe jiu-jitsu. Let's understand exactly what we're doing when we're applying those submissions. You can go on the Patreon and you can look up any of the submissions that we have on there, and it'll show exactly what we're doing, why we're doing it, and then you can understand that better. And that's the community that I'm hoping to build. I did want to do a... We kind of talked about this in the beginning, but over the next probably 18 months, I'm going to do a seminar tour, if you will. I don't... you guys use that term, so I don't want to steal that, but I'm going to be around in part of my... I'm going to be around the country, and I'll be around the world. But I'm going to do seminars of Painless, Precise, and Playful, of exactly what we were talking about. The seminars are not going to be... they're not going to have a charge, except for to join the Patreon, to join the community, so we understand how we're doing things safely, and we can ask those questions. And it will be, I guess, so I don't want to lie, there is a charge. You have to at least sign up for 1 month. Our lowest... you could sign up for free, but that wouldn't be what we required for the seminar. $5. Five whole dollars is our blue belt level. So, I'm looking forward to doing that and kind of getting behind the idea of we can do everything safely. Let's understand why we're doing it and working on that culture like we've been talking about this whole podcast.
Yeah. I think it's always fun talking to you because, you know, it's a lot of people, it's going to always be conversations on the meta in jiu-jitsu or technical base. But again, there's so much about safe gym culture or successful gym culture, which a safe and successful gym is based on its culture. And having a black belt who can understand culture is the exception, not the rule, I find, because again, we only got here because you're kicking ass. It's one of the weird things that I likened to when I was back in the fire service is the way you climbed the ranks in the fire service. You couldn't move in laterally from somewhere else to be a manager. You had to climb from the bottom. So a firefighter became a crew manager, became a watch manager, station, etc. And half of that was your ability to understand the fire ground, understand incidents, etc., etc. And that's what the tests were on. But then you'd manage people in the office. And that was more of a... You could have good managers, but they were exceptions, not rules. Like, they would just happen to be smart people who could engage and communicate well. Probably still fantastic on the fire ground, and you could have managers who are utterly awful in the office who are also very good on the fire ground. But the fact that that wasn't baked into the system, it was an accident, and that feels very similar to jiu-jitsu sometimes, is that we are... you have smart people coming through, delivering smart content, but it's not baked into the system that it's this way, which is unfortunate.
So let's bake it in the system, man. Let's fucking do it. You know, I mean, we can impact the culture of jiu-jitsu.
Yes. It's just getting it out there and getting the word spread and doing podcasts.
That's right.
And talking to people and making those videos. Are you going to be doing $5
seminars?
You first. Are you going to be releasing any content, free content, for people to check you out to then get some of this initially, or is it all
absolutely
paywall?
Yeah, we have like 25 videos up currently on the Patreon, and I would say half of them are free. Then half of them, and then every video is behind the $5 a month wall. So and like I said, we have... It's just the editing that's the problem. So we have a lot more information. Two of my other coaches for the personal coaching under Gentle Art Lifestyle, they're both jiu-jitsu practitioners. One's another black... Actually, you know Adrian Santos.
Yes.
Yeah. So Adrian's now coaching. She's a personal coach with Gentle Art Lifestyle. Okay. And so she's got information on there. So it'll be, she's got some yoga stuff, but also she's going to have some jiu-jitsu stuff. And then my other coach is named Nick Lee. And Nick has information. He's a brown belt, really good competitor, really fun role. You might have rolled with him. I think he went to.
No, I met Nick. I met Nick when I was at your gym. I do remember Nick.
Dude, that dude is the nicest fucking guy.
Yes.
He's the best.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that lives around here, so I get to do a lot of stuff with him, which is super fun. But he's also a coach on the Gentle Lifestyle Patreon. It's not just me, and it's not just about me. It's anything that's mental and physical balance. So, I don't know where I was going with that, but I'm really enjoying this project so far, a couple months in.
I'll make sure all the links are there and available for everyone. So if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple or Google or wherever you get your podcast from, go onto the YouTube. The video will be there, and there will be links to all of Josh's stuff. There are. I'll try and get a couple of the links, some of the links to your Globetrotters videos as well of you teaching classes.
Yeah. Maybe not the one that is was in competition for the most popular video.
Yeah, I was
going to
say.
You crushed
it. I was thinking that, it doesn't matter. It won't change a thing. Like,
no, your video is fucking great, man. I've watched that video a couple times myself. I'm like,
really?
How can I?
Thank you. You helped me boost it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish there was a way for me not to do that, but unfortunately, no, it's a wonderful video, and mine spiked up there, and I was right there, and then you had some like for a month or two, it was another spike that you had. I don't know what that was, but
I think it was I think because I released the Fanatics, and they really pushed it. It went on a lot of video emails, and it went a lot of. They put a lot of clips on Facebook, and I think a lot of people then maybe went onto the YouTube to try and catch up on it. And it keeps on hitting Reddit at random points, and it spikes again. No, I keep seeing your video pop up, and I'm like, that was so close. That was so so close to speed that thing came up.
Yeah. Yeah, but yours is a better video. The funny part about that is, like, I wish people would watch my guillotine and Darce videos more, because that's, like, it's all about, like, performing it in a way that is painless, which, you know, the Darce has a bad name, right? Like, so many people don't either... They don't like to Darce people because it just hurts them, or they just neck crank them. And, you know, those videos to me are like what I wish people were watching instead of how to sweep a big guy or whatever that was. But
I think that's half the problem, is that I remember watching a video recently on videography, and it said virality, you can't expect it or plan for it. It just happens, and it happens to all the things that you never really expect it to happen to. So the only thing you can then do to fix that is consistency. And if you're going to release something on a Thursday, you release something on a Thursday. You don't skip it, because as soon as you start skipping things, then people will fall out and they forget about you. And so, yeah, I think because again, that video, the amount of people who reference it, for me, I'm like, that's 5 years ago. My understanding of jiu-jitsu has changed in 5 years. Like, I have much better stuff out now, but that's the one that keeps getting found. And I'm like, just consistency.
You know what was weird?
Reality.
What was weird about that for me is, like, when that was spiking, I would go to open mats, and they'd be like, I just saw you on YouTube. You're that guy, like, you know, obviously nobody I've ever seen before. And not even at camp. I'm saying just, like, open mats around the Milwaukee area. Mm. Like, that, you know, I don't know. That was quite interesting and fun, you know.
So like a weird celebrity status, isn't it? Like, all of a sudden, like, oh yeah, you're the guy from YouTube.
Heard that always trips me. I'm sure because you're so good that you get this at camps. But like almost always at the first, like, you know, whenever if we're doing like a speed dating or something, like, I just love your videos, man. And like, you know, people really appreciate. Your video, or they appreciate what you know the information that you put out there, and it's like, oh, mine, like, okay, cool, like, thank you, you know, like, it's just not something that I'm used to, you know.
Is that a bit of self-deprecation there? Can I put that on my notes as well?
Was it self-deprecation,
Josh.
or was it trying to? Okay, all
oh,
right.
That was a balance of humility there.
Yeah, you have. I think there's a difference between humility and self-deprecation, but I'll let you mark that down. But you only have two. I'll bet you if I went and listened to our last podcast, my finger would be hurting from marking it down.
Yeah, it would.
So no, I've only found two in this conversation.
British. I'm British. It's how we operate. We've got a monarchy. We get told we're trash. Like, if you're not in line to the throne, you're a trash human being in this country. That's the way it works.
Yeah. What was I going to say? I'll wait till we're offline. I was just going to say, you know, you asked me how I was doing, and I didn't ask you how you were doing, like just in general.
Fantastic. I love the way this has all gone. I making podcasts, making videos. I did a webinar about 5 hours ago. And it's great having people come on, the same people, and we were just chatting and like asking questions. And I'm like, this is so much fun. Can't argue. And traveling the world doing jiu-jitsu. I mean, it's the best vehicle for seeing the world. And we wouldn't have met if it wasn't for jiu-jitsu.
It is.
And I think, you know, as much as we all beat around the bush when it comes to jiu-jitsu and how serious we take it and either competing or coaching or performing on the mat, it's still the best thing for meeting people. And if you close yourself off by being a douchebag, you won't meet us anywhere as near as much. And you won't make friends who are 4,000 miles away and five different time zones away.
Yeah. It really is. It really is the best vehicle, man. It's so crazy. And like, forget about, even if I'm just traveling and it's not for a camp or whatever, and I go to a gym, it's like the second that you train with somebody, they're like, let me tell you about my favorite restaurant. Hey, you want to go out to grab something to eat? Oh, you should definitely do this. What are you doing tomorrow? You know, like it's this mutually shared experience that just makes an automatic friend. It's the best.
I think it's I've likened it before to like a dance, like chemistry. When you meet someone like on the dance floor, is that if they dance like a tool, then you're like, okay, well, I don't think we jive, and this isn't going to go anywhere. But if it's a good dance, then it's like, oh, damn, this may go somewhere. I think it's the exact same with the role. As if you roll with someone, it's a fun role. And, you know, it might be one side, but if it's playful, if it's, you know, no one's getting hurt, and it's, oh, damn, we're best friends. Because, you know, we're in a situation where we could get badly hurt, but I'm trusting you to not hurt me.
Yeah.
But if you come across someone who just rolls like a douchebag and hurts you, you're like, well, fuck that guy. It might be the nicest person. But then afterwards, you'd be like, actually, I'll roll with someone else who actually might be more fun. I'll probably hang out with them afterwards. And, you know, I've been to enough camps where there's a roaming evil brown belt who's just targeting and hurting people and they get left alone. And no one wants to roll with them. And then all of a sudden they don't really get much interaction outside of that because no one gets to interact with them on the mats. Yet you come across people that it's like, let's have a fun roll. And it happens. It's like, oh, it's some chemistry there. Now we're best friends. If there's anything to then solidify that idea of don't be a mat douchebag, is it's first impressions again. I don't roll like a douche.
Let me hear more about this dancing you do.
It's dance. I don't like, dance.
Let me hear about what is it, a tango? You're doing some ballroom? you're twerking? No. What are you doing over there in England?
Oh, I twerk. Oh, dude. Yeah. Dude, I slut drop like you would not believe. Sober.
You what?
Oh, it's what? Yeah. In my younger days,
huh?
We all like you might have done these things drunk at 22, but I did them sober, which is scary.
Oh, that's awesome. That's fucking great.
I have to come out to Milwaukee soon because I don't think I'm going to see you at a camp otherwise. It's a shame I can't really swing it around Maine. But yeah, it's always fun.
Francesco
talking to you.
Was gonna he was gonna come from Maine, and now he's not doing Maine.
And
I was really bummed. He said he had some some struggles at the gym with coaches, I don't remember what it was, but so yeah, he's not gonna be doing Maine anymore. But he was gonna stop by. I was so excited to Get him a proper Milwaukee pizza, you know?
Dude, I was in Denver last month, and we went to a Colorado pizza with honey on top. And I thought, if I, you know, even though he's probably asleep right now, if Francesco is to understand that I'm currently putting honey onto a pizza, he's waking up sweating. He has no idea why.
He woke up in a nightmare right then. He's like, what? What's going on?
Just soaked in sweat. Like, what's happening? There's a disturbance somewhere. There's me drizzling honey over this thing.
Disturbance in the pizza force.
You woke up with his hands glued together like something's happening. What's happening? poor guy. I miss him. So it's been a pleasure as always.
Wait, hold on real quick. You're doing Maine?
I'm doing Maine.
Oh, and you can't swing by, huh?
I'm suddenly pondering it if I can, but I'm bringing PJ Lucy. I think you might have met him at one of the camps last year. Irish coach.
The name sounds familiar. I'm sure he's a nice guy.
He's one of fantastic. Friends. He's your Irish counterpart. He's a lovely guy.
I think I met him at Heidelberg a year or two ago, maybe.
Possibly, yes. He's a Irish school teacher. He was like, I say, you know, come to the US, we'll do some stuff, and he was like, but I'm a school teacher, Chris. I don't belong in out of Ireland. And I'm like, come on, like let's go explore. And so I finally convinced him to cross the Atlantic. It's his first US experience.
Man, I mean, you know, think about it. You know, obviously, you guys have a place to stay, and you know, we'll set up another seminar. Whatever. We can work something out and try to get you guys here if it's reasonable and if you can.
If it's a schedule, I'll figure it out. I will figure it out. But this has been a lovely chat as always, sir. I'm just looking at my camera now. The battery is currently flashing red at me, and I don't want it to die halfway through.
Oh yeah, that'd be bad.
But this is see all this you know, good quality here doesn't come for cheap, and there's batteries don't like it. But yeah, thank you for your time again. Thank you for all your input, and it's great hearing someone talk about all this. And please send me the links. I'll put those onto the bottom of the YouTube video. So thank you, Josh Janis of Milwaukee.
Hey man, thank you, and let's try to make Maine happen, or around Maine. That'd be awesome.
I'd love to. I'll see you soon.
All right, see ya.